Thank you very much, John. I really liked that last joke much better than that dumb duct tape joke you showed last year. But I appreciate you, and I appreciate your leadership. John has been a great leader of this faculty and of this faculty executive committee, and I just want to acknowledge that. I also want to note that Kathy Fuchs, Associate Professor of Psychiatry, will succeed John McCarthy as Chair of the Faculty Senate the next academic year. Norman Tolk, who's a professor of physics, will succeed Craig Ann Helflinger as Senate Secretary. I want to thank John and Craig Ann for their positive leadership over the past year and acknowledge their great work. I eagerly, by the way, do anticipate the opportunity also to work with Kathy and Norman, who will now guide the Senate's active involvement in the Vanderbilt community. And I'd like to personally thank our opening talent, Vivian Freed, who, as a professor of art history, is also the coordinator of Vanderbilt's evocative, invocative, and provocative First Chancellor's Artist-in-Residence Program. Your presentation was terrific, Vivian, and I appreciate the fact that your participation has made this all possible. My distinguished colleagues, all of whom, many of whom are here, I welcome all of you to the biannual meeting of Vanderbilt's Chancellor with Vanderbilt's faculty, in which my role as president, which is in the small p of this university, is to bestow distinction upon you and to bring you up to date on our current state of affairs. University presidents, as many of you have noted, have been much discussed this season, mostly due to the departure of Larry Summers from Harvard. Many conversations have taken place about the manageability of universities and about the relevance of the university presidency. So, in case you were wondering about my feelings in all of this, I just want you to know that I do not feel at all irrelevant. Most of those conversations, to my experience, are simply the wrong conversation to have, because in truth, I do not feel overwhelmed but empowered by the people of this room. I think the right conversation to have would be one that considers how all the citizens of a university, its faculty, its staff, its students, its alumni, can cooperate to make a powerful force. We are, without a doubt, together in a most challenging period for leadership in higher education, with public demands for strict management and a linear accountability, with the realities of life at a university, while the realities of life at a university are much more diffuse and less centralized, higher education leadership currently has to reconcile these two very different sets of cultural expectations. But for those of us in the know and for those of us inside university culture, we also know just how powerful we are, how much talent we have in this room alone, and how much force for change. Some of the scale of that power will be conveyed to you shortly through the narratives for the honors that my office privileges me to bestow. Every spring, as you well know, at this meeting, I am able to give distinction to those faculty members who have been forces for teaching and research at Vanderbilt University. And John McCarthy is here to assist me in awarding those recognitions. Let me just note that the folks who are being recognized today have been enticed here under false pretenses. They were told that they were going to listen to me. And, of course, that stimulated them to come. But nonetheless, they are here and do not know that they're going to be recognized, and it is great fun to see them have such surprise. First, I'm honored to grant the Madison Surratt Prize for Excellence in Undergraduate Teaching. This year gives me the pleasure of handing this award to Brian A. Griffith, Assistant Clinical Professor of Human and Organizational Development at Peabody College. Brian, will you please come forward? Let's just let him stand right here. Brian, come and stand right here. We're going to talk about you for a moment. Brian is responsible for coordinating the Freshman Experience Program in Human and Organizational Development. He serves as primary instructor for the two core courses required of students in their freshman year as HOD majors, Applied Human Development and Small Group Behavior. He has an excellent grasp of the developmental needs of first-year students who are adjusting to the social and intellectual demands of life at a university. To address those needs, Professor Griffith continually refines and renews the content of his courses so that they will more effectively connect the theories and research they present with the personal everyday experiences of HOD students. He excels in teaching in both small discussion and large lecture formats, cultivating a climate of trust which draws students out into active and engaged discussion, even in his largest lecture classes. He is truly a best example of an engaged and responsive teacher. So in appreciation of Brian Griffith's efforts to keep improving both the quality of his own teaching and the quality of his first-year students' intellectual lives, Vanderbilt presents him with the pewter cup and a check for $2,500. And I thank you, Brian, and congratulations. Now comes the Ellen Gregg Ingalls Award for Excellence in Classroom Teaching. This year, Vanderbilt bestows the honor upon Jose Medina, Associate Professor of Philosophy, College of Arts and Science. Jose, are you here? Oh, please come forward. Come right up here, Jose. Last year, Professor Medina was awarded early tenure in recognition of his outstanding efforts in research, service, and teaching. While we could hardly presume to add substance to that unusual and extraordinary accomplishment, we certainly can add gloss to it by honoring Jose with the Ingalls Award. Above and beyond his excellence as a teacher in the formal space of the classroom, Professor Medina is limitlessly generous with his time outside of class. He meets with his students not only as a mentor, but also as an advocate in issues of concern to them. He has served as faculty sponsor of student anti-slavery groups, as well as being closely involved with the Philosophy Club and with Lambda. The Department of Philosophy has recently appointed him Director of Undergraduate Studies in recognition of his effectiveness as an advocate for the interests and needs of undergraduate students. Jose is also an attentive and effective teacher of graduate students, teaching, for example, in his first year at Vanderbilt, a seminar on Wittgenstein, so compelling that it drew the attendance of his department chair to an entire semester. I'm not certain if that's an honor, Jose, but Jose's personal commitment to his role and responsibility as a teacher and to issues of fairness and justice in student life have earned him not only the respect of students, but also the respect of his colleagues. We're delighted to honor Jose with the Ingalls Award, pewter cup, and check for $2,500, and I thank you and congratulate you, Jose. Of course, I expect to be taken out to dinner by each of the winners. The next award I have the pleasure of granting is the Harvey Branscombe Distinguished Professor Award. This year's Branscombe Distinguished Professor is Elaine Sanders Bush, Professor of Pharmacology, Professor of Psychiatry, and Director of the Vanderbilt Brain Institute. Elaine. I might just note, as Elaine is coming forward, that if you haven't had a chance to read the Medical Center's Reporter, their news magazine, there is a wonderful profile on you, which goes on for page after page. It's fabulous. Congratulations. Elaine is a Vanderbilt institution. Let me just say that again. Elaine is a Vanderbilt institution. In her 35 years as a professor at Vanderbilt, she has mentored hundreds of graduate and medical students, as well as scores of postdoctoral fellows and junior faculty. As the current director of graduate studies for neuroscience, she takes students through the early years of their professional development. She is a wise and honest advisor to young scientists, demonstrating a sincere devotion to their advancement and a personal commitment to increasing the opportunities for minority trainees in neuroscience. She's worked to enhance minority training programs at Tennessee State University and Meharry Medical College, as well as at Vanderbilt. In 2002, Elaine developed a program through the Vanderbilt-Meharry Alliance that would enhance graduate and postdoctoral training in neuroscience. As a research scientist, Elaine has helped to build Vanderbilt's international reputation as an important training center in pharmacology. Her research on 5-HT receptors has led in every aspect of receptor studies, from molecular to cellular to behavioral levels. She is at the forefront of the study of the biology of serotonin receptors. Her election as president of the American Society of Pharmacology and Experimental Therapeutics is an honor not only to her, but also to Vanderbilt. Elaine was also instrumental to the establishment of Vanderbilt's reputation as a leader in training in the neurosciences. The cellular and molecular training program that she established in the 1990s became the basis for an institution-wide neuroscience PhD training program that was formed in 1997 and now enjoys the support of multiple grants from the National Institutes of Health. The Vanderbilt Brain Institute grew out of this program in 2002 and has become a model for cross-campus collaboration and educational programs such as the visible and accessible activities of the annual Brain Awareness Month. Elaine Sanders Bush has changed the landscape of this university, enhanced our reputation, and brought younger generations of scientists to find their strength and capacity. She has been an immeasurable influence on the lives of many. For her achievements, Vanderbilt awards her the $2,500 and the engraved silver tray that represents the Harvey Branscombe Award. Congratulations, Elaine. Fourth, let me bestow the distinction of the Alexander Herr Distinguished Professor upon James W. Guthrie, Professor of Public Policy and Education, Director of the Peabody Center for Education Policy, and Chair of the Department of Leadership, Policy, and Organizations. Jim, come forward. I might say while Jim is coming forward, I just received an email from him where he's withdrawing from another job. You're damn lucky, Jim, because this award was on the fire, on the line right there. The Herd Award focuses particularly upon the service of a member of our faculty is given to the community through his or her scholarship, expertise, and energy. I can think of few individuals to whom I would be as honored to give this award as I am to give it to you, Jim. Professor Guthrie is a powerful force in education reform, respected not only in the academy, but also in education practice and policy. He is an expert in school finance in both K-12 and higher education, in legal issues of equity and adequacy, in educational reform strategies, in the interaction of political processes with education, and in theories of education reform. In his articulation of those concentrations, he has helped to frame one of the central issues of education in the early 21st century, the definition of adequacy in the financing of K-12 schools in the United States. Jim Guthrie is called upon often as a consultant in national as well as international arenas. He has served as an expert consultant on issues related to strategic planning and the design of school finance systems for the U.S. Department of Education, the National Academy of Sciences, the National Science Foundation, the Agency for International Development, and for no less than 20 state governments, including those of Arkansas and South Carolina. He has furnished his expertise to the Ford Foundation, the World Bank, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, and UNESCO, as well as to the ministries of education and universities in Armenia, Australia, Chile, the United Kingdom, Guyana, Hong Kong, Pakistan, Romania, and South Africa, where he was able to influence reform of the apartheid educational system. Professor Guthrie's career is a model of act globally, act locally. Just act, apparently. No matter at what level you do it, Jim has done it. From Peabody, he has developed productive liaisons closer to home with the Tennessee Governor's Office and the Nashville Mayor's Office. He initiated a collaboration of Metro Schools, the Nashville Public Education Foundation, and Vanderbilt University, which designed the Principals Leadership Academy, a program that trains current and prospective principals for new leadership positions in Nashville public schools. That program is now in its fifth year. With the cooperation of Metro Schools and the state of Tennessee, Jim also guided the formation of a program to oversee the professional development of hundreds of principals throughout the state. This program, called the Leadership Development Center, is a national model and is supported by a grant of $2.7 million from the Gates Foundation. Jim's efforts to raise awareness of the links between political and financial concerns and educational reform are ongoing, as have been characterized by his dean as unrelenting. He has had an overwhelmingly positive influence on our world. So this year, for his distinctive contributions to the understanding of the problems of contemporary society, and for his contributions to the analysis and solutions of contemporary social problems, the university is proud to give the Herd Award silver tray and a check for $2,500 to Jim Guthrie, and we thank you, Jim, for your great years. Finally, I have the privilege of honoring Sankaran Mahadevan. I have practiced this for days. Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering and Professor of Mechanical Engineering with the title of the Joby Wyatt Distinguished University Professor. Maha, come forward, okay? Welcome. The Wyatt Award recognizes faculty members whose accomplishments span multiple academic disciplines. Professor Mahadevan is responsible for developing a transdisciplinary emphasis on reliability, risk engineering, and management at Vanderbilt. This initiative brought to the university and National Science Foundation Interdisciplinary Graduate Research and Training, a.k.a. IGERT, program grant, which now supports the education of more than 30 doctoral students in civil, environmental, electrical, biomedical, and mechanical engineering. The National Science Foundation has named this particular IGERT as a model for other IGERT programs. Through this program, Vanderbilt is able to help address a great need for professionals who are fluent in risk analysis and reliability engineering. The courses on reliability and risk engineering, which Professor Mahadevan has developed, do not only attract graduate students from engineering, but also from the Owen Graduate School of Management and because of the relevance of their subject matter to the improvement of health care from the School of Nursing. National laboratories and major corporations also send their star engineers for graduate study under Professor Ma Davin so that they might have his expertise translated and represented within their own organizations. In addition to training many of the practitioners in this essential field, Professor Ma Davin has written the leading textbooks on systems reliability and risk analysis. His approach has influenced practices in industries and government agencies such as Union Pacific, General Motors, General Electric, Sandia National Laboratories, NASA, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Agency, the Air Force, the Army, and the Federal Highway Administration. The White Award recognizes also the development of new knowledge from research and innovation and teaching. Within his own field, Professor Mahadevan has expanded the mathematical foundation of reliability analysis through his contributions in adaptive sampling methods, time-dependent and network-based systems of reliability analyses, and computational models for reliability-based optimization. So many of the technologies we take for granted are based on sophisticated algorithms built on risk analysis and probabilistic design. Sankaran's contribution in applied mathematics have been used to develop and improve the performance of civil engineering structures, aerospace structures, the management of nuclear waste, microelectronics, and human reliability. The recognitions Professor Mahadevan has received are numerous and include a NASA Next Generation Design Tool Award for his research on multidisciplinary reliability-based design, and he was the keynote address at the Society of Automotive Engineers World Congress. Vanderbilt is pleased beyond measure to add the Joe B. White Award to that list of honors. Congratulations, Maha. We're very proud of you. And thank you very much, John. I appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, let me just note to all of you that this has been an extraordinary year for Vanderbilt for the exactness of our alignment with the goals we set for ourselves. This year, Vanderbilt has set a new record for retention of freshmen from the fall to spring semester. I want you to embed this number in your mind, a 99.01% retention rate. We lost 16 students. That is unbelievable. Perhaps the best in the country, but that is, of course, a phenomenon that is very particular to Vanderbilt, given the fact that the transition from high school to college can be confusing, emotionally rough, or isolating. I contribute that success to all of our efforts to transform and bolster the quality of life for undergraduates on this campus. Another part of that good fortune we must owe to the discernment of Dean of Admissions Bill Shane, who at the end of this academic year will depart from Vanderbilt to a new post at Bowdoin College. In the 8 years Bill has been with Vanderbilt, our application rate has grown more than 50%, and the demographic and geographic diversity of our entering classes has vastly increased. I am personally grateful for Bill's service to the university. Vanderbilt bears the signature of his skill as an executive of admissions. His contribution to the constitution of our campus life and the quality of it is visible and palpable in everyday experience of life as we have it here. Bill Shane's service to Vanderbilt emphasizes how important an executive of admissions can be to the vision of a university and how a skillful and deft handling of that office can create the university as it is known and lived for the years to come. John Gaines, the Associate Dean of Admissions, will serve as interim dean while the provost-appointed search committee identifies and recruits our next dean of admissions. Vanderbilt has strongly recommitted itself to improving the texture of residential life on this campus, especially as we become more and more evidently, clearly and obviously, a living and learning environment. The next step in our evolution will affect all aspects of university life. As we shift gradually toward a system of college halls, the notion of service to the university will also shift. Service to the university will cease to be code for committee appointments and will expand to encompass the way we involve ourselves with learning outside of the classroom or the laboratory and a deep participation in campus life that enhances our vocations as scholars. Ladies and gentlemen, please allow me just to reiterate that point because it is so important as we move forward. There will be a new model for service at Vanderbilt. The success of our commons for first-year students depends upon you, as do all our university initiatives. Our study abroad and service learning programs, our initiatives for global health, The continuing renewal and revitalization of our graduate programs all depend on the participation and contribution of Vanderbilt's faculty. I wrote earlier this spring that there are times in the life of the university where our actions clearly define our paths for the future. We inhabit one of those times, so I have appointed four working groups responsible for creating new goals for this university. These working groups, under the direction of the Provost and of the Vice Chancellor for Student Life and University Affairs, must address issues of culture, honor, values, and wellness on our Vanderbilt campus. I anticipate being able to reveal their findings to you and seeing how those findings have been transformed into renewed goals when we assemble again in the coming fall. I encourage you to involve yourselves with the work of these committees, and most particularly the committee that is studying the process by which first-year students become oriented to the values of our university. The reconception of Vanderbilt's orientation can benefit profoundly from faculty support, particularly because the transformation of the residential life of our campus into a system of college halls is at its root a discovery of new interaction between faculty and students. I anticipate the findings of these working groups because I am always excited to have new goals. For us to continue to refine our goals and to elaborate them and sophisticate them and bring them up to date, up to this point in our life and what we need now, is vitally important to our long-term well-being as a university community. Due to our extraordinary mechanical agility, due to the great power of involvement and participation and shared ownership of this campus culture, the evolution of our practices is actually conceivable and actually possible. Now, in celebration of the spring, I am going to recommend a site to you on our campus that you may not have seen, or you may have seen too many times, or never paid attention to, or paid attention to once and then forgot about it. I'm going to recommend to you that you look at it again, but please, I would just urge you to not take that as an invitation to walk out in the middle of my remarks. I do not think that you really need an excuse to take a walk on our campus in this effusive spring, but this is a worthy reason for an outing. One of the best things at Vanderbilt, which, as you all know, is a campus full of best things, is a huge lucite and bronze sculpture in a glass case in front of the Stevenson Science Library. The sculpture, and I went by to take a look at it again today, just to visit it. The sculpture depicts in angles and dimensions of lucite the unfurling unfoldment of the universe, and within that unfoldment, the interests of science in all arrays, ganglia and galaxies, a pleosar skeleton, a cityscape, ammonites and molecular structures, girders and retorts. It all rests on the backs of twisting primeval dragons and the sun and the moon. The whole form and sweep of the thing takes your breath away because it is charged with the optimism of atomic age science, the optimism of space age science, that amazing, exhilarating faith in the human potential to sound not only the reaches of space, but also the depth of our beginnings. And meanwhile, continue to make a more livable civilization right here on this earth. Unfortunately, what one wonders now, gazing at this great jagged glass and bronze construction, is whether its dreams and expectations are still current. I'm always interested in visions of the future from the past and how we have either fallen short or surpassed those visions. I'm interested in what those visions tell us about the time in which they were envisioned, because surely they tell us more about, say, the mid-1960s, which was when Nancy DuPont Reynolds was etching these planes of lucite with her dentist drill, than they do about our present moment. Or do they? We should not let ourselves off the hook, I believe, so easily. What do visions of the future, because the sculpture addresses the future in disappearing perspective and infinite horizon, what do such visions of the future tell us about ourselves as a present that once was a future? And what is our vision of the future compared to someone else's vision of what we were supposed to be? The inscription on Reynolds' sculpture says this: scientific research forms many paths, from atoms to cosmos, reaching ever into mystery. But more and more, I am concerned with our current cultural attitudes toward that mystery and toward our place and respect to it. This sculpture, telling of the cultural mood during which it was poured and etched, expresses so much faith in the capacity of the human mind, in its elasticity and brazenness, and also in the idea that science is for all of us, that it is a cultural endeavor, and as such is worthy of the support of the culture. The solitary human figure in the whole work stands for all of human people in our apprehension of the great universe, in the clutch of its mystery in our heart. I wish, frankly, I could enjoy this sculpture in innocent exaltation. Why should I feel nostalgia of all feelings to have in looking at such a thing? But I do, and I feel apprehension because I am concerned that we as a nation are dangerously close to surrendering what has been our inheritance in the sciences. And two branches fork out of that concern, both of which are of interest and deepest need to us as researchers and as educators. The first branch is an issue of grave importance, both nationally and internationally. It is a huge national policy issue. It is the peril we are in due to the short-sighted scaling back of federal funding for scientific research and social science and for the humanities and for all forms of discovery. The proposed federal budget for the fiscal year 2006 offered a $132.3 billion research portfolio, which might seem like a great sum, except when one considers that sum is barely a 0.1% increase, an $84 million increase over last year's level of funding. That represents, to us, a cut in real terms. And although Vanderbilt University currently has the strongest NIH research award growth in the country, a 20.4% increase, and continues to exceed projections, my concern is not only about Vanderbilt, but about our colleagues at other institutions and about a shift in cultural and national priorities in general. In the early part of my tenure at Vanderbilt, I thought a lot and rallied often for the value of the humanities and to save funding for the humanities. I never in my life would have dreamed that I would have to rally for the sciences, that scientific research in this country would ever be in danger, but I rally for them now. We must use our influence as culture makers to effect a reprioritization of interest in scientific research as well as in the arts. Our intellectual, social, and economic lives as citizens of an international community are at stake. In my assembly speech last fall, I emphasized to you the need for our country to remain competitive in the sciences in order for us to remain a leader in the international community. I spoke of my alarm at seeing a super collider, the superconducting super collider at CERN in Switzerland, built by international cooperation, which caused me to wonder whether we were at work conceiving of designing or engineering anything so grand. The image of the global supremacy of the United States as a scientific leader seemed to slip away, and I saw us losing our edge to be overtaken by others. And I had recently read at that time Thomas Friedman's The World is Flat and was deeply influenced and affected by its outlook. But now I would like to make a correction, an adjustment, a refinement to what I said in the fall. For I think it is troubling, even damaging, to maintain an idea of global competition, of keeping a leaderly edge in lonely isolation from other countries. I do not think our motivation to renew our excellence in the sciences should come from such a model, that it should be so shallowly concocted as to be an idea of us against the world. We have adhered to that model, being addicted to the apparition of our own leadership for so long. I do not think we should want excellence in the sciences simply so that we can have an edge over everyone else, but rather to preserve our own competence, our own excellence for its own sake, and our own ability to participate fully in the international community. We should seek openings to be able and adept cooperators and collaborators with other countries, as Vanderbilt is doing with our strategy for internationalizing the university, for giving it a planetary reach. For we live on a round world, not a flat one, and dominance over others does not inspire us with higher purpose, is not kin to the far-flung visions drilled in Lucite that are an itinerary for the shared dreams of human people, no matter what nation. Our citizenship on this planet is a higher purpose. Our ability to function fully and to communicate with others and to be of worth and maturity. In a world of competing resources, protecting resources for education and for scientific research is absolutely critical for our security. But in this case, I do not mean security that protects us against threats from without. I mean security in ourselves, not to become less than our potential or less than what has been bequeathed us by the generations preceding our own. That is why I am so alarmed at the contraction of research and education by ideology or by political ends and desires, an agenda for power that can actually attempt to control what is stimulated as fact and can attempt to diminish the life's work of generation of scientists by qualifying or repressing or simply dismissing theories based on empirical evidence. And I shudder that scientific reports on the Big Bang and on global warming and on reproductive education could be altered or simply excised by political appointees and operatives. Universities have the capacity to increase human knowledge of the universe, just as the sculpture on the side of the Stevenson Center eagerly urges us to do, to bring clarity and light and answers and more questions. Our work is to find our way into the mystery and towards the mystery. Certainly never to admit that beyond a certain point things can no longer be known or found, and certainly never to deny that knowledge exists which has been so hard and dearly won. Our calling is to show and reveal, never to deceive or confuse or redirect for our own aims and ends. Our calling is to be a beacon on the hill, not a will-o'-the-wisp. I will admit that universities have a partiality and a bias, and it is this. We have a partiality to the capacity of humans to do amazing things when they are given the right tools and information and critical skills. And yes, I admit it. We do have a bias, and that is toward full public knowledge and full public information and free public discourse. And this is where the two... And this is where the two threads of my thought upon viewing that sculpture come together. For how can we be global citizens? How can we ever participate as a country in international scientific endeavor on a foundation built on obfuscation or spin on what I like to call, in quotes, political science, not our political science, but others, or on a faith-based pseudoscience? How can we be mature collaborators if full information is not given to us in the textbooks we encounter as students or in the public discourse we hear as adult citizens? We should work and study and produce to our fullest capacity so that we can participate in that round world, full citizens in a rich international community, able to converse with others, not divided by ideology or worldview, but always coming back to demonstrable equations and observations and communicating in lingua franca of fact and reason. If we allow ourselves to live in a fantasy dictated by superstition and fear, how can we have those conversations? That should concern you, whether you are a flat worlder or a round worlder. For if your world is flat and competition is your interest, you should be concerned that competition at that point will be long past our grasp. And if your world is round and cooperation is your interest, it should concern you that our superstition and fear will disable us from full and mature participation in a world community where what deserves the name of science is based on facts instead of faith, on empiricism instead of dogmatism. Although if dogmatism is your interest, I expect you would like such a future just fine. I dedicated my life to higher education, as have many of you, because I saw it as an essential good and because I came of age in the idealistic era when Nancy DuPont Reynolds was carving her vision of a past and a future and a mind doing all that it can to reach into them through the present. My ideas are not political ideas. They are simply the ideas and values of higher education, of freedom of thought and support for human capacity. To the last, all of us, and I certainly will defend higher education because we are a beacon, because we live out the dreams of that sculpture and of that optimistic era, because the past few months have seen Vanderbilt participate in the Scopes for Schools project, which had minority and other underserved students from area schools assembling telescopes for use in their classrooms, have seen Vanderbilt astronomer Bob O'Dell employ the Hubble telescope to map stellar winds in the Orion Nebula, have seen assistant professor of astronomy Kay von Stassen study brown dwarfs to find out why they do not become stars, have seen assistant professor of mathematics Daphne Munasaki calculate how the nautilus spiral of the inner ear boosts the strength of the vibration of sound, have seen John R. Hall, professor of chemical engineering Peter Cummings work with his colleagues at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory to determine how safe or dangerous geodesically shaped nanomaterials are for our DNA, and have seen Daria Unitmaz, associate professor of microbiology and immunology, test a serogenin compound that appears to hunt down and kill the HIV virus. And because we are at a present that once was a future, and I conceive of our duty as such to be something like this. A friend of mine carries in her wallet a photograph taken of her husband when he was in second grade. When I asked her why she would have such a thing, she answered, "So that whenever I see this picture, I remember that I am this boy's future. I want to be worthy of that role. I don't want to be a bad future for him." I believe our responsibility to the generations that preceded ours is similar. We have an immense responsibility to be a good future for them, to be worthy of their dreams of us, and not to abandon or neglect all the progress they have made. We are inheritors of a duty to continue that progress deeper and deeper ever into mystery. Where we are going might ultimately prove unplumbable, but just because we have not been the ones to find the answers does not mean that the questions are beyond our asking or the answers forever beyond our finding. And we owe it to those who come after us to bring them as close to the answers as it is in our power to do. We trust that for the generations to come after, they will do the same. Universities, as we all know, are the engine for such an approach. So with all of our might, we must protect the ability of universities to do their work, to remain places which are truth-based, fact-based, reality-based, where we can rely on the basic commodities of discernment, experimentation, and searching intelligence. I am truly proud, as I stand before you today, to be part of this endeavor, and proud to have you as my colleagues in it, all of you, social scientists and artists, and those of you who explore the humanities, and those of you who try to understand religion, and those of you who are healers and the teachers of healers, and all of you who guide students toward an insightful and skillful professional life, thank you. I say that sincerely. Thank you for the work you do, not only for Vanderbilt, but for our culture and our civilization. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, generally I take questions, but the only thing standing between me, you, and shrimp is that, and our time has gone a little bit long, but what I will do is reconvene in the Board of Trust room over here and be willing to answer any questions. Again, I hope all of you will stay for the reception. I ask those who have just won the award to come back up here and have our pictures taken. Thank you very much for being here with us today. I appreciate it.